Welcome back to the Hemingwayless podcast for Epilogue 1, Chapter 2. Before we dive into that, though, a couple of quick announcements. First of all, voting has opened for what to read next. Jump over to the Hemingwayless subreddit if you want to vote on what to read next on the Hemingwayless. Also, it would be great if someone wants to take over next year's War and Peace reading as the daily poster. You don't have to do a podcast, you just have to post every episode, every chapter, the discussion prompts. You can even recycle the discussion prompts from the previous years, that's what I do. I just need someone to be there on the daily, someone who's doing the read-through to post. So if anyone's interested in doing another read, yeah, let us know. Put your hand up. Another cool announcement. Kara Kickass says, if I organised it, how many people would be interested in a Zoom party to celebrate the end of the book? I think that's an awesome idea, and I wish we thought of that years ago. I'd be very interested in a Zoom party to celebrate the end of the book. So yeah, we could even maybe do the podcast, you know, on the Zoom. As part of the Zoom, not for the whole hangout, you know, just for 10 minutes of it. But, yeah, maybe we can have a bit of a live podcast to celebrate the end of the book. What do you guys reckon of that? Anyway, okay, so Tolstoy provides us with the analogy about the flock of sheep. Did this analogy help you in understanding his arguments? Was this a good analogy to clarify his arguments? I don't even remember. Do I remember what was... Oh, yeah, about the one that gets fattened. Yeah. So, wasn't the best analogy. It wasn't interesting, though, because I didn't know that about sheep. I think it said rams in my one, not sheep. Same thing. But that it was like one of them gets fed, especially. And to all the other ones, that one seems like some kind of a genius sheep. But actually, it's just the one that's being fattened up to be eaten. It's an interesting tidbit of information, but not really the best analogy. I'm not even really sure what it meant as an analogy. Tolstoy seems to do this, so he learns something about agriculture or farming or beehives or something, and he tries to crowbar it into an analogy, but really what he's doing is just showing off his knowledge of that particular thing. Kara Kickass says, I don't think I agree with Tolstoy's arguments, but I think it is because I have had exposure to the mathematical principles of chaos theory. Tolstoy says, I do not know why a certain event occurs. I think that I cannot know it, so I do not try to know it, and I talk about chance. He is implying that it is knowable if only our awareness was wide enough. However, chaos theory puts forth that some systems are so chaotic it is not possible to know all the conditions. Because even small fluctuations in the conditions can alter the outcomes dramatically. This is unpredictability and the butterfly effect. So even if God or some perfect being could say at the start with what the outcome would be, is that useful or meaningful? I don't think so. And knowing that small acts can have outsized effects, I think it still matters what actions individuals take. Here's a good overview of chaos theory for anyone who is curious. I am curious, but I'm not going to go down that rabbit hole right now. But yeah, thank you for bringing a bit of science to Tolstoy's argument. It was a bit of a weak argument by Tolstoy, wasn't it? But maybe that's just because his science was 150-odd years before ours. Twisted Every Way says, whew, I caught up on about 8 chapters today after Thanksgiving. I can't say these epilogues are starting off on the best foot for me. I don't even understand the sheep analogy. Rybread Egg says, sheep analogy did not help me understand his argument / crazy idea. FDLP1 says, Pierre is the white sheep, Napoleon is the feed. In conclusion, the analogy did not clarify. Yeah, no, it wasn't a very good analogy. I think what the analogy meant was, like, some things are beyond our capacity to know. Some knowledge is beyond what we know. And to those sheep, the fat sheep seems like it must be a genius because things are going its way. But actually, that fat sheep is at the mercy of a greater power, you know. Whatever that greater power is in the sheep's situation, it's the shepherd who's fattening it up to eat it. I think in the analogy of Napoleon, Napoleon's the fat sheep who seems to be a genius, but really he's just at the mercy of history or fate or a greater power, maybe just being, you know, the collective of people and their will being asserted over him. Something like that. I'm just having a swig of water. Anyway, let's read chapter 3. Hopefully it's better. I don't think it will be, though. It's a long one, and I think it's a ranty one. So here we go. Big long rant. I'll try to stay awake. The fundamental and essential significance of the European events of the beginning of the 19th century lies in the movement of the mass of the European people from west to east, and afterwards from east to west. The commencement of that movement was the movement from west to east. For the peoples of the West to be able to make their warlike movement to Moscow, it was necessary, one, that they should form themselves into a military group of a size able to endure a collision with the warlike military group of the East, two, that they should abandon all established traditions and customs, and three, that during their military movement they should have at their head a man who could justify to himself and to them the deceptions, robberies, and murders which would have to be committed during that movement. And beginning with the French Revolution, the old inadequately large group was destroyed, as well as the old habits and traditions, and step by step a group was formed of larger dimensions with new customs and traditions, and a man was produced who would stand at the head of the coming movement and bear the responsibility for all that had to be done. A man with convictions, without habits, without traditions, without a name, and not even a Frenchman, emerges by what seems the strangest chances from among all the seething French parties, and without joining any one of them, is borne forward to a prominent position. The ignorance of his colleagues, the weakness and insignificance of his opponents, the frankness of his falsehoods, and the dazzling and self-confident limitations of this man raise him to the head of the army. The brilliant qualities of the soldiers of the army sent to Italy, his opponents' reluctance to fight, and his own childish audacity and self-confidence secure him military fame. Innumerable so-called chances accompany him everywhere. The disfavor into which he falls with the rulers of France turns to his advantage. His attempts to avoid his predestined path are unsuccessful. He is not received into the Russian service, and the appointment he seeks in Turkey comes to nothing. During the war in Italy, he is several times on the verge of destruction, and each time is saved in an unexpected manner. Owing to various diplomatic considerations, the Russian armies, just those which might have destroyed his prestige, do not appear upon the scene till he is no longer there. On his return from Italy, he finds the government in Paris in a process of dissolution, in which all those who are in it are inevitably wiped out and destroyed. And by chance, an escape from this dangerous position presents itself in the form of an aimless and senseless expedition to Africa. Again, so-called chance accompanies him. Impregnable Malta surrenders without a shot. His most reckless schemes are crowned with success. The enemy's fleet, which subsequently did not let a single boat pass, allows his entire army to elude it. In Africa, a whole series of outrages are committed against the almost unarmed inhabitants, and the men who commit these crimes, especially their leader, assure themselves that this is admirable, this is glory, it resembles Caesar and Alexander the Great, and is therefore good. The idea of glory and grandeur, which consists not merely in considering nothing wrong that one does, but in priding oneself on every crime one commits, ascribing to it an incomprehensible supernatural significance, that ideal destined to guide this man and his associates, had scope for its development in Africa. Whatever he does succeeds. The plague does not touch him. The cruelty of murdering prisoners is not imputed to him as a fault. His childishly rash, uncalled for, and ignoble murdering prisoners is not, An innomal departure from Africa, leaving his comrades in distress, is set down to his credit. And again, the enemy's fleet twice lets him slip past. When intoxicated by the crimes he has committed so successfully, he reaches Paris. The dissolution of the Republican government, which a year earlier might have ruined him, has reached its extreme limit, and his presence there now as a newcomer, free from party entanglements, can only serve to exalt him. And though he himself has no plan, he is quite ready for his new role. He had no plan. He was afraid of everything, but the parties snatched at him and demanded his participation. He alone, with his ideal of glory and grandeur, developed in Italy and Egypt, his insane self-adulation, his boldness in crime and frankness in lying, he alone could justify what had to be done. He is needed for the place that awaits him, and so, almost apart from his will and despite his indecision, his lack of a plan and all his mistakes, he is drawn into a conspiracy that aims at seizing power, and the conspiracy is crowned with success. He's pushed into a meeting of the legislature. In alarm, he wishes to flee, considering himself lost. He pretends to fall into a swoon and says senseless things that should have ruined him. But the once proud and shrewd rulers of France, feeling that their part is played out, are even more bewildered than he, and do not say the words they should have said to destroy him and retain their power. Chance, millions of chances, give him power, and all men, as if by agreement, cooperate to confirm that power. Chance forms the characters of the rulers of France who submit to him. Chance forms the character of Paul I of Russia, who recognizes his government. Chance contrives a plot against him which not only fails to harm him but confirms his power. Chance puts the Duc d'Enghien in his hands and unexpectedly causes him to kill him, thereby convincing the mob more forcibly than in any other way that he had the right, since he had the might. Chance contrives that, though he directs all his efforts to prepare an expedition against England, which would inevitably have ruined him, he never carries out that intention and unexpectedly falls upon Mack and the Austrians, who surrender without a battle. Chance and genius gives him the victory at Austerlitz, and by chance all men, not only the French but all Europe, except England, which does not take part in the events but about to happen, despite their former horror and detestation of his crimes, now recognize his authority, the title he has given himself, and his ideal of grandeur and glory, which seems excellent and reasonable to them all. As if measuring themselves and preparing for the coming movement, the Western forces pushed towards the east several times in 1805, 1806, 1807, and 1809, gaining strength and growing. In 1811, the group of people that had formed in France unites into one group with the peoples of Central Europe. The strength of the justification of the man who stands at the head of the movement grows with the increased size of the group. During the 10-year preparatory period, this man had formed relations with all the crowned heads of Europe. The discredited rulers of the world can oppose no reasonable ideal to the insensate Napoleonic ideal of glory and grandeur. One after another, they hasten to display their insignificance before him. The King of Prussia sends his wife to seek the great man's mercy. The Emperor of Austria considers it a favor that this man receives a daughter of the Caesars into his bed. The Pope, the guardian of all that the nations hold sacred, utilizes religion for the aggrandizement of the great man. It is not Napoleon who prepares himself for the accomplishment of his role, so much as all those around him who prepare him to take on himself the whole responsibility for what is happening and has to happen. There is no step, no crime or petty fraud he commits, which in the mouths of those around him is not at once represented as a great deed. The most suitable fate the Germans can devise for him is a celebration of Jena and Auerstadt Not only is he great, but so are his ancestors, his brothers, his stepsons, and his brothers-in-law. Everything is done to deprive him of the remains of his reason, and to prepare him for this terrible part. And when he is ready, so too are the forces. The invasion pushes eastward and reaches its final goal, Moscow. That city is taken. The Russian army suffers heavier losses than the opposing armies had suffered in the former war from Austerlitz to Wagram. But suddenly, instead of those chances and that genius which hitherto had so consistently led him by an uninterrupted series of successes to the predestined goal, an innumerable sequence of inverse chances occur, from the cold in his head at Borodino to the sparks which set Moscow on fire, and the frosts, and instead of genius, stupidity and immeasurable baseness become evident. The invaders flee, turn back, flee again, and all the chances are now not for Napoleon, but always against him. A counter-movement is then accomplished from east to west with a remarkable resemblance to the preceding movement from west to east. Attempted drives from east to west, similar to the contrary movements of 1805, 1807, and 1809, precede the great westward movement. There is the same coalescence into a group of enormous dimensions, the same adhesion of the people of Central Europe to the movement, the same hesitation midway, and the same increasing rapidity as the goal is approached. Paris, the ultimate goal, is reached. The Napoleonic government and army are destroyed. Napoleon himself is no longer of any account. All his actions are evidently pitiful and mean. But again, an inexplicable chance occurs. The Allies detest Napoleon, whom they regard as the cause of their sufferings, deprived of power and authority, his crimes and his craft exposed. He should have appeared to them what he appeared 10 years previously and 1 year later, an outlawed brigand. But by some strange chance, no one perceives this. His part is not yet ended. The man who 10 years before and 1 year later was considered an outlawed brigand is sent to an island 2 days' sail from France, which for some reason is presented to him as his dominion, and guards are given to him and millions of money are paid to him. Alright, there we go. There's the chapter for you. Little fast-tracked, short history of Napoleon. Kind of cool. For a ranty chapter, kind of cool. It was cool to see, you know, Napoleon explained. Even if it was quite a biased explanation. Alright. Thanks for listening, guys. I'll see you tomorrow.